from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Another day, another clash between President Trump and California. The president yesterday threatened to pull fire aid from the state, tweeting that Governor Newsom has, quote, done a terrible job of forest management. Newsom shot back saying the president doesn't believe in climate change and therefore is, quote, excused from this conversation. Coming up, we'll talk about the dispute and what it could mean for fire relief in California. Then White House lawyer John Eisenberg, a key witness in the impeachment probe, defied a subpoena today from House investigators, along with other officials. What will this mean for Democrats and for the investigation? We'll talk politics after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Four key witnesses scheduled to appear before the House Oversight, Intelligence, and Foreign Affairs Committees are not expected to show up after all. This comes after President Trump tweeted that he sees no reason for lawmakers to hear from White House officials about his call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And tensions are once again heating up between California and the president. In tweets this weekend, President Trump renewed his threat to withdraw fire aid from the state for failing to, quote, clean the forest floors. In this hour of forum, we're going to talk political news and the latest on impeachment. Let me welcome Bruce Kaint back to the forum program, professor of political science at Stanford and also director of Bill Lane's Center for the American West, which has a new poll out on California's views on wildfire prevention. And Bruce, good to have you back. Welcome.
Good morning, Michael.
Good morning to you. And let's go right to this poll first. But actually, before I do, I want to go to the president's rhetoric, and then we'll go to impeachment. What the president has been tweeting is essentially a threat to withhold federal aid. And I have no more ability than anybody else at reading the mind of an alleged stable genius. But I'm wondering how you see this as actually, well, a realistic threat.
I think it's a realistic threat. I mean, he's not unconstrained because if he goes ahead and does this and he refuses aid, we've seen this with Puerto Rico, there's going to be blowback in the Congress. The California delegation is quite large and powerful. There are legal obstacles to treating one state completely differently from the other state when the other states haven't done much with climate change adaptation either. And then public opinion, we know from decades of public opinion that there's an enormous amount of sympathy for the victims of natural disasters and extreme weather. So I think he could delay things, which we've seen in Paradise. There is already a very long time of recovery, so he could make it even more miserable for people. But I suspect in the end he would lose if he were to try to do that.
Well, he seems to not necessarily rise to the occasion when it comes to any kind of placating of Congress. I mean, as we see by the fact that just this morning, and we'll, as I say, I want to go to your poll because I think it's very important for our listeners to hear about the results of that. But just this morning, four witnesses were called and didn't turn up to Congress, probably at the president's wish.
Yes, this is for those of us who are old enough to remember, this is reminiscent of what happened in the impeachment inquiry phase for Richard Nixon. That is, he was trying to keep witnesses from coming forward. He was trying to keep the tapes from being fully disclosed. He was trying to give redacted versions of things. He had people supporting him on his side that were saying this was a kangaroo court. This is all from a playbook that we've seen before. In the end, particularly if it gets to the trial phase, I think it's going to be very hard for him to keep witnesses from appearing because, after all, they're going to have some legal liability at that point.
I do want to explore in depth the impeachment as it's moving up. But in fact, let's stay on this for a moment because I think we have Jessica Taylor with us. Jessica, are you there? Jessica Taylor?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I can hear you now. And Jessica is a political reporter with NPR, has been with us before, and glad to have you back with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me go to what's opening up here with you, because there's a possible impeachment actually at this point is going to be more politically polarized than ever before. And I want to know what you actually foresee or have scouted out on that score, because we've got now a setting out of rules and rights and procedures in this inquiry, and we've got four people not appearing.
Well, I mean, yes, but we also have some transcripts that are beginning to be released. We just got a few of those today that are being released by the committee that were done, of course, behind, in private there with the committees. And then, I mean, we really are seeing, I think, a timeline that is going to have to accelerate rapidly if Democrats want to wrap some of this up before Christmas. You have the holidays now impending upon this. But and then, you know, just that vote that we saw last week to formalize this process was almost entirely along party lines, with only two Democrats voting with the Republicans on that. So, you know, I think that there's no question that the votes are there for impeachment because of the Democrats' House majority, but it's almost entirely along party lines.
Yeah, you said that it's likely this will possibly be wrapped before Thanksgiving, but there's a lot of uncertainty about that. And in fact, some are saying maybe it's not going to get wrapped before Christmas or even before, or they hope certainly before the February 3rd primaries.
Well, I mean, I don't think Thanksgiving is possible. I think that Christmas is probably more doable in the House, at least. And, you know, so that would be an impeachment vote that takes place right, you know, before the holidays. And then the trial would have to begin in the Senate. And you're right, that puts us right up against, you know, if the Senate can get it done within a month, that puts us right up against the February primaries that are beginning. And also you have a number of senators that are jurors in this inquiry that are running for president. So what do they do? I mean, it's just a timeline that we haven't faced before, because when other presidents have come under this, they've been in their second term, like Nixon and Clinton both were. And so we haven't sort of seen this pressing electoral deadline before.
As long as we're talking about deadlines, could I ask you about November 22nd? Chuck Schumer, senator, minority leader of the Senate, said that the funding deadline could actually be held up as a diversion against impeachment.
I mean, President Trump raised that this weekend when he was asked about whether, you know, he would agree to some sort of funding. I mean, these deadlines that keep happening, you know, they've always have sort of been a political football in a way, and I think no more so within the age of Trump. That, you know, we had this shutdown last year that was happening right around the holidays, and then we had another very small one. But, you know, when we are seeing sort of the acrimony raised even further because of impeachment, I think that the likelihood that Democrats, Republicans, and the White House could come together on something to fund the government, just I think it becomes an increasing likelihood that we could be headed for another shutdown or some sort of budget impasse.
Let me bring Jessica Levinson into this conversation. Jessica Levinson, of course, professor of law at Loyola Law School, and glad to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being with us. I guess the place I want to begin with you is what does it mean to all these subpoenas being defied? Where is that conflict going as you see it?
In my mind, as a law professor, it's so depressing because I try and teach my law students that legally binding documents actually have force and effect, that you can't just ignore them. And what we're seeing through this impeachment inquiry is, unfortunately, in some cases, you can. And what the House Democrats have done is they've made a political calculation that it's better not to fight all of these subpoenas, that it's better to just go forward with the impeachment inquiry and essentially to add to the impeachment that you thwarted the impeachment. In other words, adding obstruction of justice to part of what President Trump could be impeached based on. Now, that kind of meta impeachment, kind of impeachment for failing to comply with the impeachment inquiry, kind of robs House Democrats of being able to tell the full story. But to your question, it also robs all of us of understanding that subpoenas aren't like invitations, you know, come over to my house for a barbecue. It is a legally binding, mandatory legal document.
It sounds in many people's minds like obstruction of justice.
Absolutely. I think that if you look at two answers. One, if you look at the statute for obstruction of justice, I think that there's a great case to be made that President Trump and his attorneys telling people in the administration who have previously been in the administration, who are in the State Department, et cetera, don't comply with this, absolutely would satisfy obstruction of justice. But to your listeners, it's important to remember that for an impeachment inquiry, you don't have to satisfy a federal criminal statute in order to be impeached. So obstruction of justice can have essentially a different and lower threshold when it comes to an impeachment inquiry. And I absolutely think we're there as well.
And what about the constitutional questions, particularly related to the fact that the president is now saying not only the process is wrong, I mean, that's essentially what we're hearing from Republicans generally, that this process is wrong and even maybe from their perspective illegal, but that the president may have been, some senators are saying, may have been responsible of a quid pro quo, but that's just politics and that's not necessarily illegal. And there's really nothing in the statutes that says, is there, just like the word collusion doesn't appear in the statutes, quid pro quo doesn't appear.
Yeah, it's really important to separate two things. So when Mick Mulvaney says quid pro quo happens all the time, get over it, he's exactly right in the sense that the way we conduct, and not just us, but other countries, the way we conduct foreign policy is, do you want X from us? Then you do Y for us. And that Y, though, has to be of a public benefit. It has to be something like, you'll get your military aid if we're sure that it's being used well, if we're sure that you're not a corrupt country, or if you will sign this trade deal with us, or something like that, where the president can say, I made a good decision for you, the American public. The difference here is that what we get from the Ukrainian government is something that is of a personal political benefit to President Trump. So quid pro quo alone is not a problem. That is how we enforce foreign policy and domestic policy all the time. I'll vote for you, your bill, if you'll do this for me. That's not necessarily illegal. Again, the problem is asking for something where President Trump is doing something that's not for the benefit of the American people, but for the benefit of one American person himself.
That's indeed, Bruce Cain, if I can go back to you, the heart of this. And it would appear at this point that the focus will be on the withholding or the threat of withholding military aid to Ukraine to investigate Biden. But, of course, what we're also hearing from the Republicans is Biden was corrupt and Biden tried a quid pro quo to get his son Hunter a job on a board that he wasn't experienced to be on.
Right. And, if we move away from the legal framework to the political framework, that's a problem, okay? Because the president has done what the Republicans do quite frequently, which is they put up a pretext for why these calls were made and these demands were made, saying that they were concerned about corruption overall in the Ukraine. Now, that's where I think getting the transcript and finding out what else is in the Secret Service server will tell us more about whether actually the specific request about Biden keeps getting repeated or whether he was really genuinely concerned about corruption, which most of us would doubt. So I do think that this is problem politically in a second sense, and that is that the political crimes by the cynical and naive are not regarded as the same thing as people actually taking a monetary bribe or doing some obviously illegal thing. So you're getting into, again, leaving aside what the law says about all this, you're getting into an area where people don't feel as passionate about campaign finance violations, don't feel as passionate about conflict of interest. That's sort of an insider's view, again, to the people who are cynical or naive about politics. And so I would say that he could, the Democrats have to keep in mind that this is really going to be fought in the court of public opinion. You're not going to get the Republicans off of their position until they believe that it's electorally more dangerous in November than it is in the primaries.
Is it not true, though, Bruce Cain, that the Republicans are complaining about a process with respect to impeachment that they essentially put forward during the Clinton administration, a Clinton impeachment?
Yes, I mean the bottom line is that if you look at the Clinton and the Nixon, there's not a lot here that's very, very different. I mean, obviously we're in a different era. The articles of impeachment were drawn up in the Nixon years by a mixture of Democrats and Republicans. That's not going to happen here. There were more overlapping, ideologically overlapping Democrats and Republicans. That's not true anymore. So the suspicion level is a lot higher, and so it's easier to sort of frame that the process is rigged by liberal Democrats, even if those aren't the facts, even if everything they're doing is very much according to the books. that perception is going to be there because of where we are politically right now.
And let me go back to Jessica Taylor, since she is the political reporter for NPR, and I wanted to talk about politics, especially in light of the fact what Bruce has been saying about how the public's going to react. Jessica, I'd like your reading on this, especially since these are going to be televised.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I think that this is where I think Democrats could sway public opinion in their way, because that's actually what happened with the Watergate hearings, that these were huge draws and that they were able to sort of move people toward that, even Republicans that initially were against some sort of measure against the president. But I also think even we're living in a very different era than Watergate. And so while it could move some people, I'm not sure that it's going to move Republican senators by any means, at least to get to the 67 where they need. We could see a few defections among them, most likely Mitt Romney, Susan Collins of Maine, someone like that, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. But, I mean, these are – I feel like so many of these people, we see that they are just so entrenched in their opinions and it's so politically divided right now.
There was only forgive me, I just want to add a fact there that I think is important, Jessica Taylor. There was only one Republican that voted against or voted in favor of the impeachment inquiry, and that was Justin Amash, who was a former Republican, a Michigan Republican who left the party.
Right, and he left it over President Trump and impeachment. He faces a real challenge to get reelected to his seat now that he is not formally a Republican anymore. And so, you know, there were even some Republicans that had come out, you know, saying that they might vote against it, vote in favor of it, rather. Some Republicans that are retiring, Francis Rooney of Florida has come out and said that, but ultimately they did not. And this was the easier impeachment vote to take in a way, because it's just saying, okay, we're going to move forward with a process. We're going to investigate. But any Republican that, you know, dares to say, okay, let's just see what is there, they're immediately met with backlash among voters and activists, and some of, you know, are forced into retirement or switching parties.
And as long as we're talking also about the public view, the polls are kind of split. They're not put together in the questions. The questions are asked, are you in favor of an impeachment inquiry and getting at the facts? And most people say yes. Of course, it's always dependent on how these questions are phrased. But then the next question usually is, are you in favor of the president being impeached? And it doesn't square with the numbers who think that the inquiry is okay.
Right. And also, I mean, I think many in the public think that impeachment is the same thing as being removed, which it is not. It's a formal charge of wrongdoing by the House, a grand jury indictment, if you will. And then the House, the Senate rather, acts as the jury. And so I think that there's just a lot of confusion within the public exactly of all of these steps that we do not see that often happening in public. And yes, I mean, I think that when you look at the national polls, there may be some movement, certainly from what we saw even a few months ago. And I do think this, you know, this Ukraine scandal and things too is much easier, I think, for the public to understand than the Mueller hearings or Russia or something, because it was very convoluted. I mean, this does seem to be more clear cut. Okay, the president wanted something, but he wanted a rival and investigated specifically to help his political campaign. And I think that's why you did see Democrats moving forward, because this was sort of an easier thing to sell to the public in a way, but it's still not that easy. It's still, they face huge hurdles, and versus, you know, barring some, you know, seismic revelation, getting that to where they need to be to remove the president, it just looks impossible at this point. You know, and there's a section of Trump supporters, you know, he said famously during the campaign that he could stand out on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and he wouldn't lose some of his supporters. And this, some of the things he's done may be the political equivalent of doing that. That even if he did these things, you know, you're hearing people, you know, some of his, as we saw with Mulvaney coming out there and saying, you know, hey, this happens all the time, trying to sort of explain it away rather than even denying it at this point.
Yeah, and we're also hearing, and let me go to you on this, Jessica Levinson, from the attorney of the whistleblower, who's offered to answer questions, offered to actually get written questions from Nunes and answer those questions. And now there's a lot of attempt to block and obstruct that on the basis that he should appear in person, or she should appear, well, it's a he, intelligence officer should appear in person before the Congress, and demanding that, despite the fact that President Trump, of course, answered questions by letter and not in person during the Mueller investigation. I'm just curious to what you see unfolding here legally.
Well, I think what I see unfolding legally is really a political fight. So legally speaking, we have whistleblower protections for a really good reason. We want people to be able to come forward and say, I observe information that troubled me, but I don't want to face personal and political retaliation. And so, again, we basically wrap a protective blanket around these people and say, we want to, as a matter of public policy, incentivize you to report troubling behavior for the fact that it could help the country. And so the idea that this person now has to give up that protection and, you know, fall within the public spotlight, I think is just absolutely wrong. It's also just deeply hypocritical that, as you pointed out, you know, President Trump answered some questions in writing, you know, never sat for an interview. But I would also say that the question really isn't for the whistleblower as to whether or not, you know, this person has political bias. Everybody in the universe has political bias. The question is whether or not what they said can be corroborated and whether or not what we find out about what can be corroborated gives rise to an impeachable offense. The question isn't so that we can look at that person and say they seem nice, they seem biased. Again, the question is, did what they blew the whistle on, did other people confirm that with their testimony? And is it enough for impeachment? That does not require this person to essentially, you know, sit out in the open and have a be subject to these types of hearings.
I want to bring our listeners into this, and here's an opportunity for you to not only voice your sentiments, but also join us and ventilate whatever thoughts you have, but also any questions you may have. And I invite you to do that right now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we invite you to give us a call. You can reach us at 866-733-6786. Let me repeat that number. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. And I'm looking actually at some concern here about what we started out talking about, Bruce Kane. I'd like to just go back to that for a moment before we go to the break and get a quick response from you in terms of what we learned from this poll that Stanford did, actually the Bill Lane group that you're affiliated with did. We're talking, aren't we, about the Bill Lane Center for the American West actually finding out that most people don't want to necessarily pony up when it comes to fire prevention?
Right. I mean, and in that sense, while the president is deeply wrong about mitigation and the importance of mitigation, the president is probably right, not just about California, but around the whole country, about our willingness to pay to do the things we need to do to adapt to what we know will be the effects of climate change. I mean, 70% of Californians believe that climate change is real, but we continue to build onto floodplains. We continue to build in areas that are wildland interface areas. And what I find in our data is people don't want to take the hard steps. They don't want to mandate people moving. They don't want to mandate buying insurance. They don't want to even spend public money to get people to become more resilient. So we sort of talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk.
Okay, we'll leave it there, and we'll continue to talk with Bruce Kane and with our other guest, Jessica Taylor, who's a political reporter with NPR, and Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School, and you when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and if you've just joined us, we're talking about politics. The House vote is set up for the public phase of the impeachment inquiry, and as that unfurls, we'll see a release by Adam Schiff, who is essentially the head of this impeachment on the Democrat side, this impeachment inquiry, of transcripts of private depositions with what is described as appropriate redactions. That's probably for, at least on the surface, classified things. And Republicans can, of course, subpoena witnesses with the approval of Adam Schiff. And if he refuses, it goes to a full committee vote. We're going to find out what your questions and comments are. In fact, let me go, Jessica Levinson, back to you. Jessica Levinson is professor of law at Loyola Law School. Some quick questions that perhaps we can clarify for listeners. Trish writes, shouldn't any attorney who defies a subpoena be subject to immediate disbarment? They know better than anyone about the legal obligation to comply with a subpoena.
Well, that's a great question. So disbarment is a really high standard. So if an attorney can go in and say with a semi-straight face, I thought that this impeachment inquiry was improper, problematic, and or that this particular subpoena was problematic for these reasons, you're not going to rise to the level of disbarment. So state bars still give attorneys broad latitude to make bold arguments. Now, do we see a number of attorneys make arguments in this case that I think don't even pass that test that rises the level of violating ethical duties? Potentially. But again, that's a really high standard.
Another question just to follow with. The listener wants to know, will witnesses be allowed to have counsel present? That is Rick Perry's objection.
Yes. So I believe that when the House voted on Thursday, essentially the full floor vote, when they added these specific procedures for what was going to take place in the public phase, I think that going forward, people will be entitled to have counsel present.
And let me go, if I can, for a moment to you, Jessica Taylor. Tricia, one of our listeners, wants to know, why is Congress not fining or detaining those who defy subpoenas? This would clarify the Democratic objective of accountability and cast aside the supposed motive of revenge. Revenge is not persuasive. Accountability is.
Well, I think that, you know, we have seen they've appealed it, first of all, to try to claim executive privilege. And some of these matters will be decided by the court down the line. But I mean, we have seen people being indicted and charged. Michael Cohen, for example, that was one of President Trump's lawyer and fixer, was pled guilty to lying to Congress. And there's questions about whether some other testimony that has been contradictory, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, some of his testimony was being contradicted by others, including Ukraine envoy Bill Taylor. So we could see some things come up, but I think the fact that we are now seeing some of this testimony come to light and in public hearings, I think that's where the pressure will come. Okay, you didn't want to talk to us in private where you might have been more protected. I think that we will see the pressure only ramp up, and we could see that happening too.
Let me go to Professor Kane for one more question. Bruce Kane, Richard wants to know, is it really in Trump's best interest to drag the impeachment out? Sure, it galvanizes his base, but isn't it damaging to him with independents who will be seeing this seedier side of his governance?
It could happen that way. I mean, really, it depends upon what more we're going to find out. I mean, this particular fire, the political fire, as opposed to our wildfires, requires continuous fuel. And that happened in the previous impeachments that we've had, that we got, you know, further disclosures, further tapes, further clarifications of what was actually said in the White House. And that, I think, is going to be essential, because if you're simply rehearsing the memo or the redacted version that we got, or if there's nothing much more in any of the other materials that are in this server, or if we're just rehashing the evidence that was in the Mueller report, it's not obvious to me that that's going to move sentiment. If you look at what happened, the change in attitudes towards impeachment was largely among Democrats and to some extent independents, but you still don't have a majority of independents, and you certainly have only a very small number of Republicans. And the question is, what moves them? And at the same time, by the way, Trump is touting the stock market rally and a possible tax cut. So he's trying to remind people, well, you may not like me, but you're getting all these goodies. So there's a lot there that we have to take into account when we decide whether this is having this impeachment is going to work for the Democrats or against them.
He's also touting, of course, the killing of al-Baghdadi with a narrative that doesn't seem to fly, but we will continue talking with our listeners. In fact, I'm going to go right to your calls. Just to remind you, Bruce Kane is professor of political science at Stanford, also director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. Talked a bit about the new poll they put out on California's views on wildfire prevention. And let's go right to our callers. And let's begin with Jake. Jake, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got two comments. First is that it seems that the Republicans have decided that their best strategy here is to get closer and closer to the election, as kind of counterintuitive as that seems, because they seem to be going with the idea that we being the Democrats are trying to undo democracy through this impeachment, which I just find a patently ridiculous argument, because this is part of democracy. It's spelled out in our Constitution very clearly. We're not undoing an election. We are doing an impeachment. My other comment is in regards to the subpoenas not being followed. I think that what they're trying to do there is push it into the courts with the very explicit intent of, as I just mentioned, bringing it closer to the election. They want to cause a fight that pushes things ever closer until they can say, well, why are we doing an impeachment? Let's just decide in the election. And I think that's a dangerous strategy because it creates a precedent where we do not follow out and prosecute and do our constitutional duty of removing a president who's abused his authority.
Jake, I appreciate your comments and appreciate hearing from you. I thank you for that call. I'm just going to let it stand and get another caller on here right away, and that's Marcy. Marcy, you're on. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I noticed that the talk about the whistleblower getting much more scrutiny reminded me, because I am a mandated reporter, I don't get a lot of scrutiny, right? If I see something wrong in a home or with a child or with an elder, I'm just mandated to report, just like a whistleblower. It dovetails, right? Just report that you see something. I'm not supposed to be under scrutiny, right? It's supposed to trigger a session of inquiry, right, from is there something wrong?
Marcy, I understand the argument you're putting forward. Let me go to you, Jessica Taylor, on this, because essentially the Republicans are saying the problem is the whistler got this information secondhand. That's pretty much what they keep saying, isn't it?
Well, yes, but then we have also had other people that came forward and that were on the call.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the whistleblower for the president, yeah.
Yes, he does seem to double down on this, I mean, and saying he has just said inaccuracies, blatantly untruths about this, you know, as he continues to say this call is perfect. He says that they released a full transcript. They did not. There were ellipses. And actually, the readout from the White House specifically says that the Trump, that it is not an entire transcript. And so I think the whistleblower sort of becomes an easy scapegoat, especially since, you know, it's more secretive and things too. But there are laws that protect these things. There are whistleblower laws for a reason. And, but I mean, as we have seen, the president has tremendous power on his Twitter account and among his followers to sort of twist the truth and to move public opinion on this. And so I think it's just an easy sort of villain for him to cast.
Let me thank the caller and again remind you that Jessica Taylor is political reporter for NPR. Bruce Kane, we've been kind of moving back and forth between impeachment and what came out as a result of your poll. A listener wonders, this kind of brings the two together, how closely the withholding of disaster funding for the California fires may be related to the fact that Adam Schiff is representing California and is really pretty much leading at Nancy Pelosi's request. I'm adding to the listener's question, the impeachment as opposed to Jerry Nadler.
Oh, I'm sure it plays into President Trump's mind. He's got so many reasons now to hate California that we're losing track. But certainly the fact that Adam Schiff and Nancy Pelosi are in the leadership of this impeachment, that has to be a real problem for him. And that's the way he operates. You know, if he's attacked, he attacks back. And so he wants to say, well, if you're going to go after me and you're going to lead this effort to sort of impugn me, then I'm going to make it hurt for you. And this instinct, which has worked for him in business and sometimes in politics, of course, leads him to do the kinds of things that he's getting in trouble for, you know, with respect to the Ukraine call or with respect to how he handled the whole issue of Putin and the intervention in our election. So
can we call this intemperate counterpunching?
Yes, I think that. I'll take that phrase.
Let me take another caller. Let me get to Stephen next. Stephen, thanks for waiting. You're on Forum. Good morning.
Good morning. This is for Professor Levinson. I was curious about the precise scope of the Chief Justice's authority in presiding over the impeachment trial. It's obviously not the same as a typical trial judge, which controls the whole show. And there's obviously been concerns about, you know, Mitch McConnell making, you know, a short shift of any sort of trial. So I was just curious about the authority of the Chief Justice in presiding over the impeachment trial.
Comment, Professor Levinson?
Yeah, that was such a great question. So this is not like a normal trial, as you said in the question. This is, you know, we're in that weird Alice in Wonderland world of quasi-legal, quasi-political. So the short answer is that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who you have to imagine wants absolutely nothing to do with this process, is charged with interpreting the rules and procedures that would go along with this Senate trial. But Mitch McConnell has the power if he can get 51 senators to, or 50 senators to join him, meaning if he can get a simple majority, he has the power to overrule those interpretations. So Mitch McConnell, I would say, has more power in this situation. He can control the speed of the trial. He can control which witnesses are called, when they're called, how long they have. He can really fashion this, if you think about it more like a play, I would say Mitch McConnell is more of the director. Now, if you wanted to overturn the rules that Chief Justice John Roberts is applying, then Mitch McConnell would need to get two-thirds of the Senate. I think that's very unlikely. But again, he can say, I don't think you're interpreting this, these rules correctly, Chief Justice John Roberts, which you have to think would be a real shock for the Chief Justice of the United States. And so Mitch McConnell, I think, has a lot of power to control this.
And let me thank the caller for that question and go to a comment that I'm going to go to you on, Jessica Taylor. Listener says, isn't there a deeper problem for Congress in that there isn't a Justice Department that will enforce the congressional subpoenas in process? Michael Cohen was prosecuted by a semi-independent prosecutor. The Justice Department is all in supporting the administration.
This is, I think, a major problem in a way that we haven't seen before, because typically the Attorney General is supposed to be, like you said, like the caller said, enforces the laws. He is the Attorney General for the entire United States, and Democrats are arguing and have some good points to back them up. And in many of these cases, that Attorney General Barr is just protecting the White House.
There are many who are saying Attorney General Barr is President Trump's Roy Cohen, as the sort of phrasing would have it. He didn't have that with Sessions, but he's got it with Barr. He's got it like a personal attorney.
And I think that there were many people who thought that he would not be that, because he had been Attorney General before. He had served in Bush administrations, that he sort of seemed like he wasn't someone that was from Trump's orbit, but he has very quickly become a very integral player in it. And so yes, I think that you're correct. And that goes back to the subpoenas that we talked about before. I mean, it's just that we have this system of checks and balances and assurances that are supposed to ensure justice. But when there are cracks in these, and when there are people that are not enforcing what the law says, then we can see that the whole system just begins to falter in a way.
Jessica Taylor, political reporter for NPR. And let me get another caller aboard with us. And let me go next to you, Roberto. Join us. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I would like to make the comment that I believe that this is actually the problem with the Democrats. They're turning it into a political fight rather than a legal battle, or what exactly is the violation of the Constitution. And that's where I think Ralph Nader has made a very strong point, in that if the public is fixed on a certain issue, but then they have other thoughts on other issues, the emolument clause, failure to tell the truth to Congress, blocking witnesses coming in, then you have a more incremental fight, especially like Nixon, again, at that other point, where you have a constant whittling away of the foundation of what Trump has built. But instead, one issue, one party versus another. And this is why the public won't change its mind. So what do you think about Ralph Nader's position that there certainly should be more articles of impeachment, perhaps not 12, but certainly 6 or 7, and the emolument clause would certainly be large?
Well, you raise an important point, Roberto, and there are many who would like to see many things come out of this, particularly, let me go to you, Bruce Cain, because there's more access now to, well, the testimony was given during the Mueller investigation for the Democrats to use in this admittedly partisan fight. One has to ask, at this point I'm going to ask you, Bruce, how far could they go with many other things, including emoluments, as opposed to really lasering in, which apparently is the decision on what happened in that phone call with Ukraine head?
So in the past, this has happened. That is to say, and I think the caller suggested this, that there were a lot of charges that were considered for the articles of impeachment, and it will come up for a vote. So you could do that. Will it make a difference in changing public opinion? The only thing that matters in public opinion is not that you get more Democrats and probably not even that much what you do with the independents, because the calculus for the Republicans is not the general election, it's the primary, and the independents don't participate in the primary. So you can throw the independents out, you can throw the Democrats out, and only ask the question, what moves the public opinion of Republicans, okay? And that probably means that it has to hew much more closely to direct violations or things that seemingly are violations of the law, because they believe that this is a deep state conspiracy, and that unless they see real evidence that something close to a crime has been committed, I don't see what moves the Republicans from where they are right now.
Do you think they really do believe in this deep state conspiracy, the majority of them, or are they just following lockstep to what the president's bidding is?
Okay, I should be more clear. I think there are two parts to the Trump coalition. There is the actual base that does believe that there's a deep state conspiracy and really resonates with what Trump's messages are. And then there's the other faction, which is the go-along, to-get-along crowd, which is basically looking for the tax relief, looking for the stock market, all the sort of goodies that he's putting forward. And that's how he keeps the coalition together. He gives the goodies to the people that are, you know, if you like, the Vichyites, and he gives the meat, the red meat, to the base. And so I think both, he's working both sides of that coalition.
And Jessica Levinson, I wonder if it's just my sense of irony, but the president's lawyers are going to be allowed to question witnesses once the proceedings move to the Judiciary Committee. But the president's lawyers, Don McGahn et al., are kind of claiming that they're exempt from having to testify because, well, from their perspective, they have immunity. Or it's not even executive privilege. It's a sense of presidential immunity protection.
Yeah. So, of course, it feels ironic, I would say, kind of on the 30,000-foot level, in the sense that, oh, you want to participate in this, but you want absolutely nothing to do with this other box. Now, of course, those two functions are distinct. I mean, but you bring up a really important point, which are these incredibly broad claims of constitutional immunity, or maybe we do want to say it's executive privilege. But we've seen lower courts, when these cases have been brought, essentially say that would totally blow up our understanding of separation of powers. That would totally upend our understanding of congressional oversight. And I think that one of the things we're seeing from the Trump administration, and particularly from this impeachment inquiry, there's so many parts of the Constitution that we've never put under this level of a stress test before. So executive privilege, it's not in the Constitution. We just kind of understand that it's something that presidents and members of the administration can claim. Separation of powers, it's nowhere in the Constitution. We just understand it from the structure and from what the founders talked about. But we're seeing there's so many places where we just haven't tested the strength of the Constitution and how it will hold up.
Let me add one thing to that from a comment from a listener who says, so fascinating to me that we were all taught about the power of checks and balances in democracy growing up in the United States schools, but now we are being told that those checks and balances will only work depending on public sentiment and public poll results. Will children in U.S. schools be taught now that impeachment can only happen if public polls show a majority of the people, of the public, support it? Let me bring another caller aboard, and that's Ed. Ed, you're on. Morning.
Good morning. I have a question, actually, about the subpoenas. Isn't stopping people from testifying in itself an obstruction of justice? Because not everything can be executive privilege. In fact, I don't think Nixon was able to stop a lot of people from testifying or a lot of documents being turned over. So isn't this in itself an obstruction of justice?
Let's go to you on this, Jessica Taylor.
Trump has tried to stop this, I think, to a degree that we have not seen before. And I mean, he has cast it, I think, as Jessica Levinson said, was alluding to, with the strength of the Constitution being tested. He has cast this impeachment as an illegitimate process, even though it is it is designed in the Constitution to be a check on the executive very clearly. And the founders were very deliberate in putting that in there. And if you even read some of their writings, particularly Alexander Hamilton, it was to stop someone just like Trump that has sort of these great tendencies that exceed the power that they had intended for the executive branch. And so, I mean, whether he is able to stop this, we will see. But, I mean, he has gone further than we have clearly seen any president in the past in trying to block this from even moving forward and cast it in more political terms.
Let me thank Ed for that question and go to another listener question. I'm going to go to you, Jessica Levinson. This listener says, if the identity of the whistleblower is protected by federal law, can't the efforts to unmask them be prosecuted and added to Congress's list of impeachable offenses?
Potentially. So it depends on who's trying to unmask the whistleblower. I would say that the tweets from President Trump this weekend and prior to this weekend of putting enormous pressure for someone to essentially unmask the whistleblower, putting pressure on witnesses to this degree would also, I believe, give rise to witness intimidation claims. So, yes, I mean, you could see this falling within the impeachment bucket. That's really a political calculation for Nancy Pelosi. How much does she want to include? How much bad behavior does she want to put in these articles of impeachment? But it is absolutely the case that if it's the president who, as we've seen at least via the tweets, who's saying, I don't want this person to have the federal protection to which they're entitled, yeah, we could add that to impeachable offenses.
And let me go to you, Bruce Cain, about what's upcoming in terms of possible witnesses, because it appears that all the president's men, I'm using that title not even advisedly, it goes back to Woodward and Bernstein and the impeachment of Watergate that resulted from Watergate with President Richard Nixon, but that most of them are clearly defying these subpoenas. There's a question in many people's minds about John Bolton, and I wanted to have you weigh in on that because he left, let's say, under, well, so we said tense circumstances and somewhat of adversarial circumstances with the president, even though the president has now said, I always liked John.
Yeah, in fact, he called the whole business in Ukraine a drug deal and kicked the people that were Sondland and the others that were trying to have a conversation about doing this out of his office. So, yeah, there's reason, I would think, for the president to be very concerned about what Mr. Bolton might say if he was in front of.
Forgive me, especially the role of Rudy Giuliani, right?
Yes, exactly. And there's that whole kind of, I think, corrupt, unseemly behavior on the part of Giuliani. And he was right in the mix of all of this. And we haven't really, it's been for about a week or so where we haven't had as much about what he was doing and who he was operating with and what he said to various people. So that may be what we'll find out more about in the upcoming weeks.
He was operating as someone who works for the State Department when he was the president's private lawyer. Isn't that fair to say?
Yes, that's fair to say. And he was basically running his own foreign policy, not with the approval of Mr. Bolton, apparently. So, you know, that gives a lot of incentive for people to sort of speak out. And not to mention the fact that if there's potential legal liability, at some point they've got to calculate which is worse, going to jail for the president or, you know, or incurring his wrath and getting fired. And I think at that point you have a cascading effect, as we've seen in we certainly saw in Watergate. Where more and more you get people saying, no, we're not going to do this. And it takes a number of prominent people to stand up, and I think Bolton would be one of them, to really encourage the others to do the same thing.
And here is Jenny joining us. Jenny, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. I wanted to follow up to a caller, I think it was Roberto, a couple calls ago, about the broad versus narrow issue of articles of impeachment. It just strikes me that if the decision were to have gone broad, the two are not mutually exclusive. In other words, being able to show the breadth of, you know, the misactions, if you will, of Trump and going after sort of the strong legal connection with some of them. So I'll take my answer off.
We'll go to you again, Jessica Levinson, if we may.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that this is going to be a decision as to timing and as to when Nancy Pelosi can essentially wants to bring a vote for the articles of impeachment and how many things want to be included. I mean, we could broaden this out to looking at the Mueller report and the investigation dealing with the Trump campaign and the Russian government. It seems to me that right now it's staying within fairly narrow confines of, you know, this particular phone conversation and the surrounding activities with President Zelensky and the impeachment process itself. One other thing I wanted to say is Rudy Giuliani separately might be facing something called a Logan Act violation. There's an old federal statute that basically said you can't conduct foreign policy if you're not part of the State Department. Certainly, we use private individuals, we back channel, but Rudy Giuliani could be in a world of hurt for a variety of different reasons.
And a world of hurt meaning prosecution, no doubt, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So Rudy Giuliani, even though he was apparently working as if he was a member of the Trump administration, actually isn't. He doesn't enjoy any sort of immunity from prosecution. At best, that's just the president of the United States who cannot be indicted. But Rudy Giuliani is facing inquiries on a number of different levels.
We've also got an attorney general again who says essentially that executive power is pretty much beyond impeachment, at least impeachment moving forward in the way this wants to move forward by the Democrats.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit before, but you have to think that President Trump really got his money's worth with Attorney General Barr, whereas he didn't with Jeff Sessions. Attorney General Barr, I think most people thought, well, here's an institutionalist. He was previously the Attorney General. And I hear the music playing us off, but I will say he's been very loyal to President Trump. Real question as to whether or not he's been loyal to the American
people. Thank you for the responsiveness of that music, and thank you for being with us. Always good to have you, Jessica Levinson, professor of law at Loyola Law School. Thank you, Jessica Taylor, political reporter with NPR, and thank you, Bruce Kane, professor of political science with the Stanford University and director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West. Couple quick comments from listeners. A tweet from Rick who says, all the President's Men begins with a break-in, but as we learn over the course of the film, Watergate was an isolated incident in an ongoing GOP conspiracy to undermine fair elections. Why is it so difficult to understand the Ukraine call in the same light? I'll read one more comment from Stephen, who writes, the whole process makes me very sad. I'm greatly disappointed in the American people that there are so many who are either uninformed or unconcerned. Another hour of Forum is ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.